This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of June 11th, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 294. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And on the big deal feature, money and politics make the world go round. Supply chain expert Glenn Ross returns with his look at geopolitics and economics, how it all affects Wall Street and Main Street. But first, a special feature on the end of the special rapporteur. For 86 days, Canadians had a special rapporteur. They got a report, but they didn't get the tour. Former Governor General David Johnston quit on June 9th. The Conservatives, NDP, and Bloc Québécois had all agreed he should be fired. There were just too many questions of conflict of interest, especially after Johnston recommended that no public inquiry should be held into China's interference in Canadian elections. Joining me with reaction is Kenny Chu, the former Conservative MP in Steveston, Richmond East.
On June 9th in the afternoon, when you heard the news, like the rest of Canada, that David Johnston had decided to quit as special rapporteur, what was your reaction?
I have a deep sense of feeling sorry for the respectable David Johnston here, because, you know, like, for those Canadians who've been observing what happened in Ottawa, David Johnston stands out as a tremendous governor general. I mean, if you consider the series of symbolized governor general symbolizing this, that, and, you know, when Stephen Harper appointed him, it's obviously, on just meritocracy. He's somebody that can, he can rely on to do a good job as a governor general. Unfortunately, I feel that he's been used by the current Prime Minister Justin Trudeau because of that background. It's almost like, if you listen to the House of Commons debates, it's almost like the Liberals are saying, "Oh, he had been chosen by Prime Minister Stephen Harper to be the Governor General, so he must be good for anything," which is completely, it's a fallacy, because what we know that what's happening right now is when Canada is facing foreign interference, specifically vis-a-vis with the Chinese Communist Party interfering with our business, even targeting not just ordinary MPs like Jenny Kwan, or even shadow minister like Michael Chong, even the person who is running to be the Prime Minister of Canada, Aaron O'Toole. The fact that he completely give a blank slate for the current government, the Liberal Party of Canada, it's really unfortunate for Johnston to do that. And we, as Canadian, we learned this term called special rapporteur. But if you can see the copy of the report that I have, I just noticed that just like Mr. David Johnston said today, that he is an independent special rapporteur. And I mean, I don't understand who gives that word independent, because part of the problem is we need, as Canadian, as the country of Canada, we need to get to the bottom of this. And there's a lot of why, when, how, and what that needs to be answered. And unfortunately, Mr. Johnson's, because of his past association with the government and the Trudeau family, and specifically his positive speeches and also attitude towards the People's Republic of China regime, he is, just like Jamit Singh said, being seen as the appearance of bias. And unfortunately, you know, most Canadians can see that, demanding for an independent public inquiry. But Mr. Johnson did not see that. In fact, he went against the will of Parliament three times. That's been expressed by majority motions that have been passed by majority of the MPs. And he insisted in conducting public hearings, and he volunteered himself to conduct these public hearings. So I feel very bad for an eminent Canadian like himself, but unfortunately for the government, a highly capable country like Canada, somehow they only pick him and also pick somebody who, you know, they can rely on. So, and I think he's just being a victim for, you know, the government's attempt to cover up, and being held to account by Canadians, through their elected member of parliament in House of Commons.
But was this really just damage control to protect Prime Minister Justin Trudeau from some serious allegations and from the main questions? What did he know and when did he know it?
It surely does lead people to think in that direction, doesn't it? Because, the special rapporteur somehow had set for himself a deadline that he had to make a decision. And in the, only a few days ago, House of Commons committee's hearing, we learned that it seems like he hasn't even been able to access all the information and see all the evidence. He surely has not interviewed the people that's necessary to provide the information. For example, Aaron O'Toole, according to him, David Johnson had already drafted the report and sent it for translation into French before he actually sat down and spoke with Aaron O'Toole. He did have a few pages to cover Steveston, Richmond East. In my case, because there have been media indication that the riding has been having more than fair share of Chinese interference, but Mr. Johnson and his, resourceful office has not even bothered to contact me, let alone talk to people like myself. In the case of Mr. Han Dong, read the documents and also the news report correctly, he also has not talked to Han Dong, or that he's spoken with him and already trust what he said. Taking its face value. So the whole thing gives people the impression that, Mr. Johnson, it's in a hurry to prove that nothing to see here on the government side, and, public inquiry that would, call people, subpoena people, witnesses to it, and put witnesses under, a legal binding conditions would not help somehow. And, public hearings of the diaspora communities, how they are under the pressure of dictatorial regimes from, Russians and Iranians to, communist Chinese, would be sufficient. And unfortunately, I think what we have seen thus far and what some of the whistleblowers have risk their careers and even their personal safety on, means that Canadians have gone too far. We cannot be satisfied with that. And it's really unfortunate that he could not see, like I said, Jagmeet Singh referred to as the appearance of bias, and therefore he would accept, to step down as the parliament demanded. What I think, Bob, it's the last straw on the camel's back is Mr. Enro Tools, speaking in the House of Commons on the point of privilege, and indicating that there has been a significant contradiction of what David Johnson said in his report versus what CSIS had updated and provided to Aaron O'Toole. And that has just basically left Mr. Johnson to have no place to stand. And I think after a few days of clear-minded retrospective, he has to face the reality that he is just way too close to the subject matter itself. Doesn't matter whether it's, you know, Trudeau family or the Liberal Party of Canada, the Trudeau Foundation, or the subject China itself. And he also, unfortunately, doesn't, like you said, it seems like he couldn't see that, you know, people surrounding him are either somehow affiliated with Trudeau Foundation or Liberal Party of Canada, like you said, the chief attorney, you know, the person that he consulted to determine whether he has a direct conflict of interest. It's, you know, somebody he had known for 50 years and then also served on the Trudeau Foundation, like himself, a retired Supreme Court judge. So that it, like I said, I mean, it's really unfortunate. Good people sometimes would have made bad choices and bad decisions. That's a lesson I learned.
That was Kenny Chu, the former Steveston Richmond East Conservative MP from 2019 to 2021. What do you think? Email bob@thebreaker.news. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.news podcast. Money makes the world go round, and so does geopolitics. Joining me to break down the impacts on Wall Street and Main Street is a return guest, international supply chain expert Glenn Ross. He is president of ACC Group in Surrey, British Columbia. Glenn Ross also publishes a weekly newsletter on supply chains and a daily update on the Ukraine war.
Here we are, west coast of Canada, North America. High fuel prices and inflation are still top of mind, making headlines every day. What is it doing to the economy right now, and what should we look for in the months to come?
COVID-19, in my opinion, has permanently changed the way the world looks. Just look at what's going on lately. The political changes, the tribal changes in Africa and Asia. You're looking at the Ukrainian invasion. Okay, that's an extension of 2014 and 1991. But certainly COVID-19 has had an effect, and it's not going to go away. The effect is not going to go away. Some of that is helping inflation. Now, if you look at inflation around the world, I mean, they're all tracking down except for Japan. Japan is still here at 4.25%, up from 4%. You know, the rest are more or less there or thereabouts. The US is leveled out just a shade under 5%. France and the Eurozone and the EU are still heading down. The UK is still the highest, but having the sharpest drop. If you look at the Canadian side, you know, we're tracking around about 4.4%, which is the lowest we've been since last year, June, July. So second lowest was 4.3 last month. So, but if you look at the food inflation, which is what people see from a day-to-day perspective, food inflation is still hovering around the 8.5-9%. The last number that was published by the government was 8.3%. But so food inflation is still around about double what general inflation is. Now, there's a lot of rhetoric around, a lot of, you know, we had the Canadian government having these interviews with Loblaws and with Walmart and these guys, the food retailers. We had the same thing happening down in the States in front of Congress. And unfortunately, in my opinion, there was nothing more than political pontificating. It's nothing more than these guys who know nothing about how food retail assembles its price structure. They don't know anything about it at all, but they get up there and they shout and scream and ask questions and threaten. But the real message is to their voters. Look at me, I'm looking after your interests, but they know nothing about it. And I'll give you an example. You look at the dollar stores, and you did mention to me earlier about people buying down, and there are people buying down and coming in. It's the same thing that happened to when Walmart started out in the 80s. It took prices down, so people flocked to Walmart. Walmart's Achilles heel, of course, was its bottom basement structure was attacked by the dollar stores and took them down even further, which are really secondary retail stores, you know, the big stores that can't sell, sell to the dollar stores, and they discount it down and they make some type of margin on that. But the dollar stores, if you look at pre-COVID, the average value in US dollars now of a 40-foot container coming from Asia to North America was about $35,000, $36,000 US. That's the average value of the contents inside the container. And the average ocean freight was about $1,000, $1,200 to get it from either Malaysia, from China, from Vietnam, into ocean port to port, $1,200. One of my customers was paying $990. That same customer was paying $34,000 during COVID. Now, that excludes the $2,000 location fee because they will book for space. You know, ship is like a bus. They sell you a piece of space. Now, if you don't get your container on the ship, they're still going to charge you because they've reserved that space for your little 40-foot container. But now you've got to go and find a container somewhere in Asia to load your products into. Because when COVID struck, everybody was sending medical supplies all over the world. And where they were sending the containers to, there was nothing really coming back. So trade works in and globalization works in a two-way process. You send something, you receive something. In the initial stages of COVID-19, it was one-way traffic. So there are hundreds of thousands of containers still lying all over the world with nothing to put into them to bring them back. It's a $1 trillion cost to bring all those containers back. There's 260,000 containers at last count stuck in Russia. And because of the embargoes and the sanctions, they can't get out of Russia. There's about 35,000 stuck in Belarus. So a third of a million containers lying there out of connection. So you look at all that type of stuff. So you go back now to the Dollar Tree, the dollar stores. So $35,000 cargo, $1,000 ocean freight. The ocean freight goes to $35,000, $36,000. So now suddenly a dollar tree store is a $10 tree store. Otherwise, they're going to go out of business. And that's why you've seen all the dollar stores start adjusting up to $3, $4, $5, $6 with a base of $1.50. It's no longer a dollar store. So if you take that and you put it back into the food inflation, Loblaws and these guys, food retailers make on average about 1.92% gross margin. Not a big margin. That's why they have to go into these big, huge stores to sell as much as possible to get the economies of scale in their favor. So there's not much room in the big stores for deflation, inflation, all those bits and pieces. It really, they have to have a steady ship as they go on, as they've got labor unions, they've got all sorts of stuff. So now, suddenly out of the blue, the imported stuff, which goes into the center aisle of retail stores, they're now paying $30,000, $25,000, $26,000 a 40-foot container. So that pushes prices up. But on the food side, most of our food in Canada comes out of the States and Mexico. You look at the oranges come out of Florida, out of California. You get a lot of stuff out of Mexico. Now, that's a long-distance haul. So already our food is subject to a very short shelf life. Where I come from, where we live just about on top of the farms in Africa and in London, and we used to air freight the stuff in from around the world, the shelf life of grapes, for argument's sake, was literally double what we get here in Vancouver. You buy grapes now in Vancouver stores, they last you about 5-6 days and you throw them away. We could keep them there for more than a week, no problem at all. So they have to get that stuff into the stores in Canada. The problem is there were no truck drivers. What used to cost me $2,000 to go from Vancouver to Houston was costing me $10,500 because I just couldn't find a truck driver. Either way, the rail lines were congested because all the containers were clogging them up. So that effect pushes up the price of food and it goes back into the food retail price. Now, was there some gouging? Of course, there's always an element of gouging. Just look at the steamship lines. You know, they made off with billions and billions of dollars of profit. They made hay while the sun shines. So right now, the price of ocean freight is now back down to about $1,200, $1,400, which is a huge problem for the ocean carriers because their break-even point is around about $1,100 to $1,250, depending where they're going, on average. So anything below that, they're losing money. So the pendulum has swung completely the other way again now. So I don't see inflation, particularly food inflation, dropping dramatically in any time shortly. I really don't see that happening. If I then cascade into the Ukrainian war, Ukraine produces around about 68 to 70% of the world's sunflower oil. That's down by 45 to 50%. With the dam breaking now in Kherson, That's going to affect it even more because there's 40,000 square acres, sorry, square miles that are now underwater. You know, so that's going to affect the price of food again because there's three generally accepted preservatives of food in cans and bottles. Ceylon solution, olive oil, and sunflower oil. Olive oil is more expensive, obviously. Ceylon solution has a different taste effect. And one of your most predominant uses is, of course, sunflower oil. We can't get that anymore. Fertilizer was a bit short during COVID-19. Now it's back to an even keel again, post there. But there's still a debate right now between Russia and the EU about allowing ships to transit through the Black Sea and through the Bosphorus and back into particularly the African countries. But it's not going to happen overnight because they want to quid pro quo in some other area. So just the fact that the sunflower oil is going to be seeing shortages because we're still using last year's crop is a huge problem. Ukraine hasn't even yet planted this year's crop. So food inflation is here to stay, just like gas inflation is here to stay. I mean, gas is tracking higher than it's been before, but not as high as it's been at a peak. But certainly it's not good news from a consumer perspective, which is, of course, putting pressure on the political side, particularly in the States where people can't afford to buy groceries and feed their families. You're starting to see a lot of politicization of the post-COVID-19 effects.
Are we looking at a slowdown that becomes a recession?
Well, let's just talk about the recession. Every coin has two sides. Governments step in whenever the prices go too high, real estate goes too high, and they try to dampen the economy on the way down. Inflation is not the government's worst enemy by any stretch of the imagination. Inflation adds to GDP, and a growing GDP is always something a government brags about. So if you look at the Chinese are estimating 5.4% GDP. If they get about 3.4-3.5%, I think they're going to be lucky. In the first 4 months of this year alone, January through April, the Chinese industrial profit margin was down 19%. Now, 18% of millennials in China own apartments. It's the highest ratio in the world. In China, the government doesn't fund the provinces. The provinces sell real estate to get revenue. And they put some of that revenue, they put back to the federal government. But then they sell the land to the developers, Chinese developers, like Evergrande and those guys. And then those guys then sell it to you and I. But there's a difference between our mortgage system and the Chinese mortgage system. In China, you pay for your house before you take occupation, even before it's been built. So I buy an apartment somewhere down in central China, and I pay my mortgage. I go to the bank to borrow the money, and I put it in. It's like a huge Ponzi scheme, Bob, because the developer takes that money and goes and buys more land because they're making more money by doing that. So in the meantime, I've paid for my apartment. They haven't even started sinking bricks yet because I have to pay for it up front, but I'm paying my mortgage off in the meantime. So the Chinese government tried to step in and said, we need to dampen this down a bit. You know, more than a third of our economy is based on real estate, and that's a huge bubble, a huge Ponzi scheme. And they introduced the three red line policy, which stopped the flow of money. So now suddenly the developers couldn't build. And the money they'd received to build, they'd already used to buy other elements, more land. So it got into lockdown. So their cash flow dried up. In the meantime, the people who have bought those apartments then started saying, hang on, you know, what's going on here? And they stopped paying their mortgages. And as of 2 days ago, 259 economic zones in China are refusing to pay mortgages, which is a huge problem. And that's more than 35% of your growth, of your annual budget and your annual economy. That's a huge problem for China. So now we come back and say, okay, China and Russia are obviously trying to align themselves with BRICS, and they're trying to create a bipolar or a multipolar world. And I think it's going to happen in one way or another. They're trying to de-dollarize the world, but it's not going to be as easy as that because for the dollar to stay in effect, it needs a central banking system, which it has. The Russians, the Chinese, the South Africans, the Brazilians, and the Indians don't have that. And India has all sorts of problems with China invading its northern borders. And there's no ways on heaven's earth is India going to buy into a central bank system in China. It's not going to happen. So de-dollarization, I think, is the topic of the day at the moment. I don't think it's going to happen. But come back now to the recession. So we keep hearing comments here and snippets there about recession's coming. Bannon puts up the interest rate by 1%, et cetera, et cetera. They're trying to dampen it down. But look at the other side of the coin. What better way to get back at China without firing a single bullet is to have a recession in America and the UE. The EU and America, the US, account for 68% of Chinese exports. That is their market. China is nothing more than an extension of those two economies. It's their manufacturing base. 68%, more than two-thirds of China's output goes to the European Union or to America. So what happens now if America and the EU have a recession and you dampen down, we stop buying, and we stop buying disposable cash goods? That is the staple diet of the Chinese economy. It drives GDP down. That now means you start laying people off. But don't forget, 90% of the Chinese people living around the basins, the Mekong, the Yellow River, all in the coastal zones, a lot of them have moved from the interland into providing cheap labor in the cities and what they call the economic zones. Now, the problem is, when you start laying them off, they don't have money to send back to the families out in the farms. China's biggest fear is a revolution a la 1949, Mao's long walk he had, and he took over China in 1949. That's their biggest fear. Not America, not Ukraine, Germany. It is a repeat of that particular revolution. China's government policy is all gearing up to 2049, from 1949, to make it the 100-year anniversary. They want to have a huge, they want to be the biggest economy in the world, et cetera, et cetera. I believe there's some merit in the fact that our recession is in some ways being manufactured. It's a way of getting back into the Chinese economy, which is now becoming one of the dominant forces in the world financially. And how does it mean? You look at the UK and America last week announced they're going to join forces to try and suppress the Chinese growth factor, as did the EU. So if I was in their shoes, I would certainly seriously consider, what can I do to drop the demand rate out of our countries or of the Chinese manufacturing base? That will create problems for China that nobody else wants. China needs $1 trillion to equalize its healthcare. The non-Han Chinese population don't have the same healthcare as the Han Chinese. It's going to be $1 trillion for them to equalize it. If they don't equalize it, they're going to have a revolution. So there's problems in China that's just not just military or the Bashing Strait south of Taiwan to worry about. They have financial problems, huge financial problems. In 2020, in their census, they miscounted, they overcounted the population by 120 million souls in 2020. Those people are all post one-child policy, and most of them are childbearing age women. A huge demographic bomb that's going to go off in China in the next 5 years. Huge. Taking that into account, global economists now estimate that China peaked 5 years ago. They thought they would peak in 2027. They now estimate it peaked 5 to 10 years ago was their peak. And they reckon by 2050, they're going to drop by 300 million to 400 million citizens because of their demographic disaster that's coming down the road. So if you look at the demographic pyramid, it's built like a pyramid. The top piece are the old age people. They are the pensioners, the guys we are going to be getting onto shortly. And generally speaking, those people invest in the economy. They don't work. They don't go out and buy motor cars and houses. They've done that in their lives. They invest. They take the money, they invest in pension funds, et cetera, et cetera. The middle section is the section that drives the economy. It's the people who start working. They're buying houses. They're buying cars, cots, prams, food, baby food. And then the bottom section, the broader section, are the babies, the future. Okay. If you have an imbalance in that triangulation, you've got problems. You go look at the demographic triangles of, or the demographic profiles of Russia and China. Disastrous. Absolutely disastrous. They reckon 190 million Chinese are going to be pensioned in ages in the next 5 years. They haven't got money to cater for the existing guys. Where are they going to find the money for that? So when you come back to recession, if we start pushing buttons that manufacture a recession, China's hurt without firing a bullet or a missile at them anyway. Depends what their reaction is going to be. The question the Chinese need to answer is, what is the rate of GDP they need to sustain a stable society? That's the question the Chinese are trying to figure out the answer. All of that, of course, cascades back because China needs to feed those people. That's why it needs to go to the Arctic. They call themselves now a near Arctic state because they don't have an Arctic border. Russia has the biggest Arctic border, has laid claim to the biggest underwater shelf life and stuff, where there are trillions of dollars of wealth, but more importantly, fish. But China is now the venture capital company behind Russia. Russia doesn't have the money. Russia's economy is smaller than California's economy. They're going to run out of money, or are running out of money for this war, never mind what they're going to do in the Arctic. In steps China. Well, we've got a couple of $1 billion we can get you. We can buy things from you. You know, come on board with our One Belt, One Road situation. And on the back of Russia, they're going now into the Arctic. So Russia cannot do without China. And China, just as badly, cannot do without Russia. It has to have Russia. It needs Russia's fuel and energy supplies. And it certainly needs access to the Northern Passage, as they call it, in the Arctic. Because Canada and the guys haven't yet got going. Russia has more nuclear-powered icebreakers than the rest of the world put together. And they've got 7 on the blocks, which they maybe run out of money to produce. The rest of us, we're fast asleep at the Arctic wheel. We really are. If you go if you go down to the south, where you have a large Australian presence, but huge fish supplies, but there are international protocols in place down there to protect the fish and the climate and that type of stuff. But China's going in there nonetheless. They're going there nonetheless. So, yeah, so it's not a good situation going forward, Bob. COVID-19 has exacerbated it. It's lifted a lot of the green curtains out of the way so we can see the problems for what they are. The millennials are coming through with a different mindset to the rest of us. You'll see that as American politicians unfold and go forward, you'll see more and more leftward-leaning political votes happening now, which is why you've seen the Republicans scrambling to deny people the vote, because they're a minority party. They have been for 7 of the last 8 elections. The only time they were higher was post 9/11, George Bush's election. And that was more to protect themselves. But they're a dying breed. They're a dying breed, the Republicans. And they're trying desperately to see how we can't get the votes. So how do we stop the other side from voting? And you'll see more and more that, okay, yesterday was a landslide, was a landmark decision made by the Supreme Court, insofar as Alabama is concerned, but it doesn't change the gerrymandering and all that type of stuff in all the Republican-dominated state legislatures. It doesn't stop that. So you can see these things are changing the world in front of our eyes. So in a way, I'm happy. I'm alive. I can see this unfolding because I love the change. But it also provides grounds for concern as to where's it going to go, because a lot of the hooligans are coming out of the cupboard. You know, and you look at down south, Trump, he unleashed the guys in 2008. Because of taking away a lot of the legislation and stuff, you had the financial disaster down there. And nobody really went to jail or got sanctioned or penalized for that. So 2 cycles later, political cycles later, they said, you know, along comes Trump and he says, I'm your messiah. I'm going to help you. I'm going to save you. I'm the man. I'm the blue-collar man. And they voted for him on block. Of course, it was a mistaken vote, but it's still trying to unravel itself. But in the process, the genie's out the bottle. The loonies are out of the reserve. You know, so we still have to see the effect of that as well, you know. And you've got DeSantis down in Florida, who's Trump on steroids, but he's got a bit more veneer over in what Trump has. I don't think he's going to go anywhere, but still, you know, he's not the only guy in the states, in the 50 states and other parts. So it's worrying in that respect. But sanity always seems to prevail. It always does. I mean, you had the 1917 Russian Revolution. We had the 1991 Russian Revolution. I think we can have another one in the next 3 to 4 years. We will not beat Russia with a gun or missiles. Russia will beat itself from within. Now, there's 82 different provinces and republics and whatever they call them. All of them are funded by the Kremlin. Kremlin's got no money. They can't find money. They're relying on the Chinese for money. And what does that mean? That means all those little mini oligarchs all throughout the 82 states and republics are in danger. So there's any fragmentation that's going to happen, particularly if you look at Siberia East. That's where you're going to have problems. If you look at Central Asia, which has always been Russia's backyard and one of the 9 gateways into the Russian mainland, they're out of sorts there too. Armenia and Azerbaijan are fighting with each other. France is busy arbitrating between the two of them, not Russia anymore. So it's all changing in front of our eyes. Just got to hope it's, I think it'll be for the good, but there'll be some troubles along the way.
If you look at the calendar, just over a year from now, France is hosting the next Summer Olympics in Paris. Emmanuel Macron, we saw him recently in China. He has had a dialogue over the months and past year with Putin that other leaders have not had. The leader of an Olympic hosting country trying to do whatever he can to maximize that for his own political gain, for his own political career.
France wants to be the leader of the EU. As I said, it's a fragile balance there at the moment. But France has got other problems. You know, only now have they realized that Russia and China are trying to oust them from Africa. And they've got the Wagner group with Prigozhin running riot in Mali and Central African Republic and all those places. So France is in the Horn of Africa, and they're under attack from the African countries. They're saying you're a colonial power, and we've got nothing to say thank you for, and you can actually give us some resurrection here. So they've got that problem. They've got a huge Muslim population within France itself from their colonies. And they are by no means in any stretch of the imagination quiet. So they've got problems looming ahead, but France wants to be the leader of the EU. Italy's not going to make it. Belgium and Holland and those guys are too small. The one to watch for, the country to watch for is Poland. Poland is stepping up in a huge way. Now, Poland's the old Lithuanian-Polish empire, held reign over the Prussian Empire, what is today Germany, and what is today Ukraine. That was all part of the old Polish-Lithuanian Empire. Not so long ago, 150, 100, 200 years ago. But watch Poland. There's a great book out there called The 100-Year War. And it talks about a future power zone stretching from Poland all the way down through into Turkey. And Ukraine happens to be in the middle of that. But you've also got Bulgaria and Moldova and those countries down there as well. And they reckon that's going to be the next 50 to 100 years is going to be the power zone of real import of the world, splitting west from east. So China, I think, is starting to falter. Russia, we know, is going to have huge problems ahead. Europe is emptying its coffers to help the Ukrainians. But Poland, to me, is the real dark horse, internationally. Poland is, to me, the dark horse. You've got to watch them carefully.
A whirlwind tour of the world economically and geopolitically. Always a great guest to have on the podcast. Thanks again, Glenn.
Thanks, Bob, and to your listeners. Have a great day.
Thanks again to my guest, Glenn Ross of ACC Group in Surrey, British Columbia. For more information, go to accgroupco.com. What do you think? Email bob@thebreaker.news. Breaker.news podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Taiwan news, Taiwan offers reward for revealing foreign interference in elections. Maximum reward will reach 10 million new Taiwan dollars or $437,000 Canadian. A separate maximum reward of more than $200,000 Canadian will be available if a whistleblower can come up with proof of gambling related to the election outcome. Taiwan will elect a new president, vice president, and 113 legislators on January 13, 2024. Outside interference and gambling were the two main issues for the elections, according to the Supreme Prosecutor's Office. The statement followed a meeting held in Taitung County on June 8th to discuss related issues. In the Hong Kong Free Press, Jimmy Lai case. U.S. lawmakers urge U.K. to help sanction Hong Kong judges as city government slams interference. Media tycoon Jimmy Lai, 75, who has been remanded in custody since December 2020, is currently facing trial under the Beijing-imposed National Security Law and the colonial-era Sedition Law. In a statement issued on Thursday, the Hong Kong government condemned the U.S. Congressional Executive Commission on China and its call for sanctions on judicial officers and prosecutors, adding that they were, quote, interfering in judicial proceedings, end quote, in Hong Kong. In ABC News Australia, women rangers sharpen shooting skills in mission to control feral cats in central Australia. A study found a single feral cat in the bush kills 740 animals per year on average, and according to the federal government, feral cats threaten the survival of over 100 native species. In Australia, those species include the bilby, the bandicoot, the bettong, and the noombat. Feral cats can be controlled by shooting and trapping, but shooting is labor-intensive and requires a lot of skill. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, Shemaya Fagan spent taxpayer or donor money on hotel pet fees, airfare for her kids. She says she's done nothing wrong. Oregon Secretary of State's office employees repeatedly told their former boss that she was bending, if not breaking, state travel rules by bringing her family along on state-paid business trips. Before she resigned, Fagan explained that her annual state salary of $77,000 was not enough to make ends meet as a divorced mother of two. In Edir, Seattle, Canadian Asian supermarket chain TNT is opening its first U.S. store in Bellevue. The massive new 76,000-square-foot flagship store will open in summer 2024 at the Marketplace at Factoria. Expat Canadians who are TNT heads will no longer have to drive up to British Columbia to score TNT brand green onion pancakes and other goodies. With all that room, TNT is also going to have a sushi counter, noodle station, hot food bar, and an in-store bakery that will make pastries and cakes as well as buns and bao. In Czech news, Vancouver Island Raiders team equipment stolen again. Team officials tell police they were in the building at 110 Wall Street, Nanaimo, in the early evening on May 21st and returned around 5 p.m. on May 22nd, which is when the break-in was discovered. The incident is believed to have occurred between those times. Stolen items include 20 Nike Vapor footballs, 5 travel bags, 2 Riddell helmets, 2 pairs of football cleats, team jerseys, girdles, game pants, and assorted tools and equipment. That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone.
The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to people across BC who are living with ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, the people who care for them, and the people who are searching to cure this disease. June is ALS Awareness Month in British Columbia. Find out more at the ALS Society of BC website, alsbc.ca. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of June 11th, 2023. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 11th of June in 1963, U.S. President John F. Kennedy proposed the Civil Rights Act? Kennedy was assassinated later that year. His successor, Lyndon Johnson, signed it into law in July 1964. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews.
Until next week.